Empire Lines uncovers the unexpected, often two-way, flows of empires through art. Interdisciplinary thinkers use individual artworks as artifacts of imperial exchange, revealing the how and why of the monolith empire.
In this episode, James Marriott traces the flows of Britain's global oil empire in the 20th century. From a village in Nigeria to the Beatles' 1965 vinyl, Drive My Car.
Asked a girl what she wanted to be. She said, "Baby, can't you see? I want to be famous, a star of the screen. But you can do something in between. Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm going to be a star. Baby, you can drive my car, and maybe I'll love you." Written by Paul McCartney and John Lennon in 1965, Drive My Car was one of the Beatles' early tracks. It helped transport them on their way to global success when it was released on the Rubber Soul album on the 3rd of December 1965. Within a handful of years, the Beatles had become an international brand and a music and publishing empire, Applecore Limited. It's easy to believe that the British Empire was played out in the 19th century by men in top hats, generals in uniforms, and women in long dresses. But the British Empire of the 1960s, the empire I was born in, was one of men in business suits, pop stars in mop tops, and women in sports cars. This was an empire of petrochemical plants, jetliners, vinyl records. We can call it late empire, an empire built on petrol, plastics, pesticides. And the history of this track speaks less of Beatlemania and more of Britain's global empire of oil. Nigeria was formed as a British colony in 1914, partly as a result of rivalry with the German Empire. The British colonial forces sought to dominate the land of what is now Nigeria in order to deny others access to coal, tin, palm oil, and crude oil resources in the region. The British government felt that it didn't militarily assert its power over this land, then its rival would beat them to it. A German company had already been prospecting for crude oil, the basis of petroleum in the Niger Delta. After 46 years of struggle and resistance, Nigeria won its independence from the British Empire in 1960. However, there was no change in the control of the country's mineral rights. The license to drill for oil throughout the whole of Nigeria had been granted by the British government to a joint venture company run by Shell and BP in 1936. The company discovered oil in quantities that were profitable to extract in 1957. However, for the Nigerian state, winning independence only 3 years later made no impact on the rights of Shell and BP, who continued to exploit oil under the contract granted by the British government. In the autumn of 1965, crude oil was pumped from deep beneath the delta up to a drilling rig in the village of Bodo in Ogoni in eastern Nigeria. The liquid was then pushed through that pipeline that ran from Bodo to the Bonny oil terminal. Compressors at several pump stations along the 20-mile route drove the liquid over farmland and across creeks. The line juddered as the crude pulsed through the steel tubes. Farmers and children had to step over the pipe that ran directly across paths from villages to the fields and waterside. The pipe was a giant syringe drawing out wealth from Ogoni, out from Nigeria, into the bloodstream of the British Empire. At Bonny, the crude was gathered in massive white storage tanks, awaiting the arrival of a ship from Europe or the US. Waiting at the jetty was the MV British Admiral, BP's first very large crude carrier, or VLCC. With a dead weight of over 100,000 tons, it was capable of carrying a cargo of 500,000 barrels of oil. This massive vessel had been built at the Vickers Armstrong shipyard in Barrow in northwest England and launched in March 1965 with full ceremony by the Queen and Maurice Bridgman, chairman of BP, in attendance. The ship was a symbol of the prowess of that late empire, British Commonwealth. Clad in white shorts and knee-length socks, the crew set the ship's course for the Atlantic horizon. In the heat of the Gulf of Guinea, the coast of West Africa shrunk to a thin purple line, rounding Cape Verde and heading north, bound for Britain. It was a calm crossing of the sea roads east of the Azores, and after 2 weeks, the crew sighted land at Scilly. Passing between those islands and Land's End, the British Admiral entered the Celtic Sea and made for Angle Bay Ocean Terminal at the mouth of Milford Haven in Pembrokeshire, Wales. In 1959, the directors of BP had sanctioned the financing of the Angle Bay Ocean Terminal. The company had constructed a concrete jetty leading to a pumping station, from which a 65-mile steel tube was laid in a trench running beneath the estuaries of the Taff and then the Tyvee. In contrast to Ogoni, the oil in Wales passed entirely underground, out of view and out of mind of farmers and schoolchildren. This pipe became a syringe injecting the drug of oil into the economy of Britain. The amount of crude arriving at the gates of Llandarcy Refinery increased from 1 million tonnes to nearly 8 million tonnes a year during the 1960s. This refinery at the heart of South Wales was expanded to turn the raw material of crude oil into standard products such as naphtha feedstock, the lifeblood of petrochemical plants. A further pipeline was built to pump naphtha from the refinery to the heart of a new BP factory on Baglan Burrows. Baglan Burrows, or Baglan Moors, was an extensive area of sand dunes that curved around the edge of Swansea Bay, stretching for 4 miles between the Avon and the Neath rivers, just to the east of Llandarcy Refinery. On the hillside clustered the homes of retired coal miners, while farms nestled on the slopes. The sand dunes were occasional grazing for sheep, places to collect dewberries in summer, and a wonderful playground for the children of Port Talbot. In 1960, it was chosen as the site for a revolution, as transformatory for Wales as the drilling rig in Bodo was for Ogoni. The previous year, the National Coal Board had announced the closure of 3 mines in Port Talbot, Glenhafod, Aberbiden, and Pentre. As pits were rationalised in the West Glamorgan coalfield, employment in South Wales mines continued to rapidly decline. Some found work in the Port Talbot steelworks, but others moved away. The age of coal was clearly waning, and that of oil, and petrochemicals in particular, was waxing. Prior to the 1950s, chemicals from oil had been almost entirely manufactured in the US. But by 1962, Britain was the largest petrochemicals producer in Europe, making plastics, synthetic rubbers, man-made fibre textiles, detergents, and more. Under the chairman, Sir Neville Gass, the BP board recognised that the world of petrochemicals offered the prospect of a whole new market for oil products, a whole new territory of profit. And if BP did not stake its imperial claim over this realm, then its competitors would beat them to it. The essential weapon in their conquest was the cracker. This was a machine that took naphtha and broke it down into ethylene, propylene, olefins, and butadiene. These chemicals themselves became the raw materials for products such as polystyrene, synthetic rubber, PVC, and so on. They were the building blocks for the industrial manufacture of food, housing, clothing, transport, household goods, pesticides, and much, much more. Out of a cracker came a whole new world. In 1960, BP already had 3 crackers in operation at its Grangemouth plant outside Edinburgh in Scotland. By building another, it would become the largest ethylene producer in the UK, outstripping its rivals Shell and ICI. The company's aim was to make the Baglan plant in Wales as important as Grangemouth in Scotland. The ethylene plant was the heart of the new Bagland factory. Each year, 60,000 tons of the chemical was produced from the naphtha feedstock, adding 10% to the UK's ethylene manufacturing capacity. But the ethylene wouldn't make music until it was combined with other chemicals too. Ethylene dichloride, or EDC, was produced by adding the chemical chlorine, imported by rail from the distiller's factory at Sandbach in Cheshire. This was then exported to other factories nearby, like Barry, Newport, and Stroud. Several times a week, a train of tank cars would travel south from the Bagland plant to the distiller's factory at Barry. There, the EDC was turned into vinyl chloride monomer and then polyvinyl chloride, or PVC, the wonder material of the plastics age. Taken together, these factories and processes comprised a seven-estuary oil province stretching from Angle Bay to Stroud near Gloucester, with Bagland at its heart and BP firmly in command. Wales was transformed through the building of infrastructure that could ingest a massively increased crude load and then process it into petrol, pesticides, and plastics. The last of these three was the raw product that fueled pop culture. Some of Barry's PVC's output was loaded onto road tankers that busied along the new M4 motorway to the EMI record plant in Hayes, West London. Nearby, the Beatles were recording their new album, Rubber Soul, at EMI's Abbey Road studio. After 13 sessions between the 12th of October and the 15th of November 1965, the tracks were cut into lacquers on lathes at Abbey Road, which was used to create the metal master at Hayes. The PVC was poured into the moulds, and with all the machines running, Hayes produced 750,000 records in the firm expectation of high demand. As the Beatles' success soared, copies of the album were sent out across the UK. Delivery trucks rolled back down the M4 again to Derek's Music on Church Street in Port Talbot. It was the first dedicated pop and rock shop in Wales and had been keen to pre-order the Beatles LP. On the 3rd of December, the album went on sale, and from radios and dance sets in Sandfields by Bagland out rang the words of the first track, Drive My Car. Carried on the liquid rocks from beneath the Goni, the sounds of the Beatles spilled out into the South Wales air. We can imagine a family moving from elsewhere in South Wales to work at Bagland in the 1960s. They might have rented a home from the Port Talbot Borough Council in the Sandfields estate. The man of the family was employed to work in the plant next door. On returning from the factory, coming home at the end of the day, as he stepped inside, he would have found that the carpet underlay and the floor tiles were made from styrene monomer, the emulsion point on the walls from vinyl acetate, and the ceiling tiles from polystyrene. Phenolics made up the electric light switches and plugs, whilst the bulb cable was coated in PVC. The windows were sat in PVC frames. The foam in the cushions on the settee was from propylene, and the cabinets of the TV, radio set, and dance set were cast from styrene monomer. The shelf of albums and the rack of singles, like Drive My Car, were all PVC. In the kitchen, the refrigerator, washing machine, vacuum cleaner, and electric iron were all made partly of polystyrene. The bowls, buckets, and bottles of detergent were from polyethylene, the rubber gloves and sponges from styrene monomer, and the pipes that brought water to the sink were PVC. Even the food in the fridge and cupboards was wrapped in PVC packaging. Out in the garden, the hose was from styrene monomer, and drain pipes, water butt, and flower pots, and plant trays were all from PVC. When he turned to passionately kiss his true love, she wore a dress made of vinyl acetate, and her lips were covered in propylene. Almost all that he touched could have poured out of Bagland. Although the Bagland factory did not manufacture any household products, the intermediates that it made were transformed in other plants into the building blocks of a home. Just as the ethylene dichloride from Bagland was transformed by factories in Barry and Hayes into the Rubber Soul album, the plastic world of comfort was designed to draw profit from the crude pumped out of Africa and onto the British market. However, these blunt economics were hidden by the dazzling colours of white, clean modernity. In 1965, just 8 years after BP began extracting oil from the region, Sam Badilo Bako, a schoolteacher from Ogoni, wrote an open letter to Shell BP. "Today we need education. We need employment. We want to eat. We want to live. We don't want our children to remain out of school. We don't want to lack for money because Shell has removed land, which used to be our main source of revenue. In short, we do not want to live in a vicious cycle in which we shall see Shell BP as the authors of our misfortune and our oppressors. Is it not an irony that those who live on top of wealth should be the poorest people in the nation?" Drive My Car reminds us that we still live within this empire of oil and the systems exposed by the track. Oil is still extracted from the Niger Delta. Gas, too, is exported by ship to states such as the UK. Delta gas may be fueling the power stations that generate the electrical powering that powers the device that you're listening to right now. The task is to build and imagine our way out of this empire of oil and create the artworks, the music, that embodies a new way of being after empire, after oil.
Empire Lines is produced by Yelena Sofronievich. For more episodes, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.